On our earth, before writing was invented, before the printing press was invented, poetry flourished. That's why we know that poetry is like bread. It should be shared by all, by scholars and by peasants, by all our vast, incredible, extraordinary family of humanity. That was Pablo Neruda. I'm Bob Holman, and this is the Poetry is Bread podcast, where poetry challenges us, makes us think, and with imagination and courage and heart, changes the world. Here we have Marge Piercy, poet, novelist, progressive activist, writer of all sorts. Her work includes Woman on the Edge of Time, He, She, and It, which won the 1993 Arthur C. Clarke Award, and Gone to Soldiers, a New York Times bestseller, sweeping historical novel set during World War II, and Dance the Eagle to Sleep, a book that was my Bible back when I was in the Heves Tunis, which meant heavy on the tuna fish casserole, Heves Tunis commune in the late 60s, early 70s, a book that predicted a marvelous utopia of communes and a day-by-day guide to how to get along with each other. Thank you, Marge. Her work is rooted in her Jewish heritage, in communist social and political activism, and feminist ideals. She is a remarkable poet with over a dozen poetry books. And our focus of this episode of Poetry is Bread is on being a poet and an activist, similar to Pablo Neruda. For Marge Piercy, her fight for women's rights and abortion rights helped dictate the dystopian literature that she focused on. Well, Marge, how did you get first involved in the women's rights movement?
I was very involved in women's liberation. I was part of an early group of women in Students for Democratic Society. We met together regularly to discuss and figure out how to counter the sexism and the anti-war movement of the time. As soon as the first women's liberation office was set up in New York, I started organizing consciousness-raising groups out of it. I was involved in all the marches and everything, and I spoke at a number of the rallies, and that went on for a long time. In 1970, I was one of the women to speak out on abortion at Judson Church. When I moved to Cape Cod in 71, I started Cape Cod Women's Liberation, and that was very successful till it was brought down by Rolling Rock Beer. We were raising money with a dance, and a woman who was very affluent and didn't understand money, the other people didn't have as much money, ordered a whole lot of Rolling Rock beer. Well, not very many women drank it, and it turned out it wasn't returnable, so it bankrupted the organization. And then I started a Now chapter on Cape Cod, and I was the legislative chairperson for that for a long time. And when that died out, we started Roots for Choice, Roots of Choice. And we helped women, we escorted women to abortions and back from it and to any place, anything else they needed. We did a whole, and then we also started the whole thing of dealing with the police department so that they would understand domestic violence, and we educated them all. We had a judge who was part of the group who was very good at talking to cops. And so now all the police departments on the Outer Cape have a domestic violence person, usually a woman. And, we did all kinds of things like that anyhow, so I've been very involved.
How did all these movements affect each other and your ideas?
Well, I was in, I was incorporating things I knew from a whole lot of different movements. The American Indian movement, civil rights. I'd been involved in civil rights before the anti-war movement. All the different ideas that I liked from all the different movements, I incorporated into the utopian society.
What happened to these movements?
It wasn't the change in the feminist movement. It was the change in society. The Quantel probe program under Nixon had infiltrated the movement and essentially brought it down. A lot of people were in jail. A lot of people were underground. Global warming was becoming a fact, something. There was a pushback against feminism very strongly and against a lot of the liberal ideas of the time. So things were changing. Things were going backward and downward.
How do social issues affect your writing? Let's take global warming, for example.
Because you see the things that I wrote about. First of all, global warming is no longer a matter for scientists. We're living it and dying of it now. The oceans are rising. There are more and more serious storms. Every year is a little warmer than the year before it. It's affecting the ecology. I'm a gardener. I don't see the birds I used to. I see a whole lot of different insects than I used to. There are different weeds. Some trees are dying that were flourishing before. Thing you can feel, if you're in touch with the earth, you can feel the climate change. I go to the ocean. What do I see? I used to see the whelk. I used to see egg casings. I used to see all kinds of shells. Now I see plastic tampon inserters. I see lots of things from all kinds of plastic waste from everything. That's what I see when I go to the ocean.
What was it that you saw and helped you form these opinions for your dystopian books?
I just looked at what was happening, how powerful corporations were becoming. I was involved with computers very early, even before there were PCs. I was time-sharing on a computer in New Jersey when I lived in New York. I was into PCs as early as they existed. I was on the internet when it was so clumsy. It was the World Wide Web, and you had to type everything in capital letters and everything. I understood what it was going to become. So I anticipated a lot of what has happened in He, She, and It. We're not there yet, but we're getting there. And I could see what I'd done power structure research in the movement. So I understood how corporations function, how they use their power, how interconnected they are. They don't have nationalities. They don't belong to nation states. They have no loyalty to anything except the people on their level and their power and their organization. And I can see how it's changing in that direction, that corporations control more and more of the lives of people who work for them. Are they too fat? Are they too thin? What is their genetic makeup? What diseases might they have? What drugs do they use? We don't let them use those drugs, etc. This prying into, inserting themselves into people's lives, I just carried further in He, She, and It.
Marge, how did science and technology affect your writing?
First of all, I've been married to two scientists. I kept marrying scientists early because I thought they knew things I didn't. I was fascinated by, I felt I could encompass all of knowledge except for what, for instance, physicists did. And so I married a physicist because I thought it was so fascinating. Big mistake. That's what I did.
How did the scientists react to your work?
Well, I knew people in the, understand, I got to know people in the AI at MIT, in the AI lab, who actually became huge fans of Hishi and It when it came out. One of them published a glossary of Yiddish terms for the benefit of people who didn't know Yiddish for the book. It was, you know, the I was interested in AI. So that's where I learned a lot about how Yod would have to be.
What questions did you ask them to help you with?
Well, what are you doing? What does it mean? Where are you aiming to go? What can come from this? All those questions that laymen ask of scientists when they get a chance.
You did a lot of research on your books, hmm?
No, I don't. You know, I made a lot of notes at the time. They were assimilated, and that was, what, that was my fifth, sixth novel. I mean, I've wrote 17 novels. I researched a lot of different things for all of them.
Did the research affect the structure of the books?
Yeah, everything is very organized. Everything is very precise. It's like a grid pattern imposed upon the entire world.
How do your values influence your dystopian futures?
Sure. That is the utopian novel is. It's basically, I'm a woman, I'm a feminist, I'm on the left, that's how I think. So anything I invent incorporates those values. So it's not a matter of deciding, well, I should do this. Though I did think about the protagonist, and I decided if I was a good society of the future, I wouldn't want a normal white male from this time to come. I'd want somebody who was a person of color, somebody who had come up out of the hard times and poverty and grimness that people live in now, that I grew up in. I would want somebody like that to come and visit me.
Do you think your work was subversive?
I don't think about it that way. Everything I do is subversive. You should see my FBI files.
What do your FBI files say? Is it true?
Oh, yeah, it's very inaccurate. The CIA files on me are accurate. The FBI files are largely fiction. They hired such complete nuts to do, who were their informants, who were very lazy. So they'd sort of make up things.
Going to Cuba, being an activist, must have drawn a lot of attention to you. Can you talk about that?
Well, first of all, I was one of the founders of NACLA, the North American Congress on Latin America, which is one of the reasons I was invited to Cuba. I spent a summer in Cuba in 68 as a guest of the Cuban government. I was an off-campus organizer. I was in the SDS regional office in New York, Students for Democratic Society, and then started off-campus movements. We had city planners for Democratic Society, teachers, social workers. I can't say the name of the affinity group, I guess. In a podcast, can you say anything? Okay, the motherfuckers, up against the wall motherfuckers, were one of our affinity groups. They were a motorcycle gang, but they were leftist. We did a lot of off-campus organizing and so forth.
Sorry, can you go back to the files? What did they say?
Oh, where I was, what I did, but a lot of it was fiction because I wasn't at the places they said and I was doing other things at the time. It really was a lot of it nonsense, whereas the CIA was very accurate.
Is it easy writing a female protagonist as opposed to male?
Well, and I've written male protagonists, but But it's very natural for me to write with a female protagonist. I mean, I've written many male protagonists, and in Gone to Soldiers, half the characters are male. And the same with City of Darkness, City of Light. I mean, I wrote about Robespierre, from Robespierre's point of view, from Danton's. And Robespierre scholars have told me it's the best job anybody ever did.
Are the characters based on people you know?
Basing people on characters you know generally doesn't work terribly well. So the third or fourth time you meet a particular constellation of characteristics, you begin to understand what that means. The first time you meet somebody very charismatic, you're knocked out by them. You don't analyze them unless you get angry at them. It's after you've met a number of such people, you begin to understand the character makeup. What they're seeking, how they feel, how they perceive the world, how they use other people. It's over time that you understand characters. That's why I create very strong characters. Plus, there's always a piece of yourself in them, and a piece you'll probably never live out otherwise. But we often have very strange, Americans particularly, ideas about how the borders of an individual are. But every time you're in a serious relationship with anybody, you change. You become a slightly different person. This happens all of the time in lives. We're much more fluid than we know. We reach out to other people in all kinds of sensuous and emotional, intellectual ways, and so we're constantly evolving as we live. Even your dog or cat that you're very close to changes you somewhat.
How important is technology in your novels?
Technology is completely neutral in the beginning of it, but what technology gets produced and what doesn't is totally political. You have the ability to have a whole lot of different ways of generating energy. Which ones get pushed is a totally political decision. You always have to ask about technology, who pays for it? Not even initially, but eventually. For instance, with wind turbines, those large wind turbines, the people who pay for it are the people who live within a mile and a half of it, who can no longer sleep, whose nervous system goes to shit, who really suffer all kinds of things. But they're being pushed by the energy companies because they are massive. They require much more outlay of money than solar. You can make your house solar without spending a fortune. Small windmills don't do that. When I was a child, once you drove out of Detroit, you saw a small windmill. Every farm had a small windmill. They didn't do any damage. It's just these huge ones that can endanger life around them. It's a matter of there's not much being pushed with hydroelectric or wave power, except I think in Scotland. I think they're dealing with it in Scotland. All right, well, we've gone. Oh, technology, look. Streetcars were an extremely efficient way of moving people around. They didn't pollute. They were wonderful. When I was a child, you could go all over Detroit in streetcars. But the automobile manufacturers were far more powerful. GM, Ford, Chrysler. And they passed down an edict that streetcars were more expensive to run than cars. Well, they weren't. And streetcars almost banished. And cars are all over the place running over pedestrians, bicyclists, and polluting madly. And here in New York, you can't move hardly on the streets in a car.
cyborgs seem very sexual in your novels.
I remember when my agent at the time, Lois Wallace, read the novel, she said, "I want one. I want one." Because he was programmed to please. And basically, by the time you're in your 30s, New York women are special in what they want with men. They want power. They want success. But most of us, by the time we're in our 30s, we'd much rather have a man who can fix the toilet than a man who looks like an underwear model.
How are cities represented in the future, and what are they influenced by?
Well, they're the glop. That's something that I picked up basically from cyberpunk. And I felt it was a playground I could play in as well as the writers from cyberpunk. What they were doing interested me a lot. I felt that the cities were going in that direction. Right now, smaller cities are. Larger cities, something else. I read an essay for the book the PM Press brought out, My Body, My Life, about the gentrification of the center of cities and people being pushed out. So that is something that I didn't anticipate when I was writing. But my great deal of cities are still glop, and the smaller cities.
How do these cities affect the environment in your books?
Basically, when you go to smaller cities, you see that the life's been sucked out of them. The manufacturing is left, and it's just often the downtown is dead. It's really, you can see there was once a very vibrant city there, but it's gone now. Go across upstate New York and there's a whole bunch of such cities, and it is so sad. The life has been sucked out of them by the corporations moving the jobs abroad. Basically, the corporations have created domes where they are safe. The people that work for them in higher positions are safe, live inside these domes where everything is controlled. It's a perfect corporate entity. And the day laborers come in and are taken out and go back to the glop. And I see a lot of that, the decay of the parts of cities that haven't been gentrified, that there's public transportation isn't good in most places anymore, the infrastructure is falling apart. They're always finding schools that are full of asbestos. Our bridges are falling down. The potholes in New York are absolutely amazing. You go bumpity, bumpity, bump. It's like nobody cares. Things fall apart. The water, it gets contaminated. The air is now, under Trump, we're going to go back to when I lived in New York and had to frequently get out of the city because I would get sick from the air. We would have to drive out to Montauk Point and stay there until the alert was over.
Does chaos challenge creativity?
Chaos doesn't create creativity, but a less ordered place enables you to do what you can imagine or try to do what you can imagine. It's part of, and often it's cheaper. That's why artists are moving into Detroit. You can get space in Detroit for much cheaper than you can in the more affluent cities. Artists have largely been driven out of San Francisco. When I lived in San Francisco, I worked as an artist model. I don't think I could make a living there as an artist model. Well, now, of course, I couldn't, but I mean, you know, but it was just a lot of places were full of energy then, that now have been the people who create or who have new ideas or who are willing to take chances, not in technology, have been forced out.
Do you fear dystopias?
Yeah, I think so. I'm afraid of that. I dystopias are created out of fear. If this goes on, this is what's going to happen. Nobody shifted their trust. They grabbed power. They began to exert their power. People don't trust corporations. They just run things. They run elections. They buy candidates. They own the media. They determine what you see. They determine what you think you should look like. They determine how you should dress. They determine these things. There's a certain amount of street stuff that comes up, but then it's co-opted and they earn a lot of money off of it. Not the people who created it.
What will happen with anti-abortion bans started by Donald Trump?
If he has his way, women will be dying in large numbers as we were of back alley abortions. Or do-it-yourself abortions, which is what I did at 18, and almost bled to death. I spent years helping women get abortions before it was legal, and I'm ready to go back to that. Now, we've been talking, me and a couple other activists, about what to do, how to set up a network of safe houses for women in places where abortion is still legal, so that they can have a place to go and stay free. We're talking about that now, what to do. But one of the things that Trump has done is stir up an enormous hornet's nest. He has gotten people politically active who had never been politically active or hadn't been politically active in 30 years. It is possible, if people keep at it, that we might create a new, very powerful resistance movement that may move the country back. The right is trying to push us back to the 50s. They want that world where white men controlled everything. Affluent white men had the whole world. Women were subservient. Blacks were in their place. Hispanics didn't exist. It's just, that was such a great world for them. And they want that back. They've never stopped wanting that. And a lot of these people are of an age where they remember it. All these old white men are in power now. And it's very dangerous for all the rest of us. Because they don't care if we live or die. They don't really need a lot of the people anymore. They don't, what they do, it's just, they've moved the jobs out and they're gone, and they're also bringing in more and more robots to run them. They don't need the working class anymore. We should all die. Get out of the way. We cost too much. We insist on living longer in the Social Security we paid into. We insist on getting it back. That's unfair. We don't deserve that. They want that money. There's all that money sitting there in a pot that a bunch of useless old people are taking out. And we should all just die.
How do you fight back?
You organize, and you don't spend a lot of time fighting with people who disagree with you on two or three points, which is always the vice of the left, is to start fighting with people who agree with you on 85 points and not the other 15%. That's easy to do, to go out and organize people who don't agree with you yet. That's what has to be done. You have to reach those Trump voters who voted against their own self-interest. You have to reach them. They're angry, they're frustrated, and they have a fucking lot to be frustrated about. Their lives have gone downhill. They don't see a lot of hope for their children. Do you know, they talk about the drug problem. The drug problem is a hopeless problem. It's a problem of kids not being able to see anything in their future that they can really look forward to except debt. The drug problem is not a drug problem. It's a problem of people being squashed, of people being oppressed, of people seeing no hope, of people not seeing things they can do that look good.
Are you still writing novels?
I don't write novels now. I'm writing short stories. Well, I think The Handmaid's Tale is very appropriate. I think I've written it. I don't see a lot to add to what I created in He, She, and It, unfortunately. Probably more pressure on women than even I imagined then. Though I assumed that they were all patriarchal, the corporations, but it's... They really want us to be slaves to biology the way we used to be. And we haven't been in 40 years. They want that back.
What was it like when abortions were illegal?
For instance, when I was helping women get abortions, I was dealing with a woman who said her gynecologist would do it, and he did. So she came back, and she started hemorrhaging. So I called him, and he said, "I have no patient by that name," and hung up on me. So I was in my apartment with this woman hemorrhaging. I had packed her with ice. I did whatever I could. I finally did manage to stop the bleeding. But I thought, I'm going to be here with a corpse by morning. I'm going to prison. I had another friend who had enormous trouble getting pregnant. She was married. Finally, she got pregnant. And in the fifth month, she miscarried. Well, when you miscarried then, they assumed you'd aborted yourself. So she came in the hospital and she lay on a stretcher in the hall, and nurses and doctors went by her and nobody gave her anything. She was in excruciating pain. She was losing the baby. She was bleeding. They ignored her, except a policeman came to question her. So it wasn't just abortions. If you miscarried, you were liable to die of that from neglect because they assumed you'd aborted yourself. there were certain very good abortions. Like there was one in Illinois that wasn't called the mob, it was called the syndicate, protected. And he had very strict rules. So always came with a woman friend. He kept you after the abortion to make sure you weren't going to have any problems. So there were some that were really good. It was, however, extremely difficult. And you had to be very careful what you said on the phone, et cetera. You had code languages. They forget what it was like. It was being in love could kill you then.
Thank you, Marge. Very powerful stories from a remarkable poet and human being. Let's conclude. I'm going to read a few Marge Piercy poems. Here is "Visions Depend on Us." When eyes are unbandaged, light thunders in. It hurts, but who cares? Sight is back. Fear of blindness drowned. When I wake in hotel rooms, at first I'm shipwrecked, lost. This is not my bed. No cats sleep at my feet. All wrong. When dawn creeps into strange rooms, objects solidify out of the dark. A bear becomes a chair. a bureau resolves from truck. A hanging robe is no longer intruder. Eyes report, but the brain interprets, making monsters from drapes. People see only skin instead of a person and create stories, threats. If it's not a mirror, how frightening is the other? Witnesses are unreliable. Prisons swallow mistaken faces, bodies. We see what we think we see. Occasionally, that's harmless. Another poem by Marge Piercy, World That Doesn't Lack an Ending. World without end, they say, but everything comes to its ending. My life, my body, everyone I love, my cats, the weeping beech, hemlock, the maples and white fir I planted decades ago. This land, the sea will take back into itself, the rock far down, the sun itself. But we are hastening all, burning the world as we sit, as we drive, as we eat. After us, not the deluge, but the desert. Anthropocene bringing to dust not just us, but lions and tigers, polar bears, monarchs, warblers, right whales. We must worship death, though we never look straight into its sockets. Still we court it so passionately. War is a constant. Waste, greed, it's Saturday night. So much will die with us that never lit a match, never built a nuclear power plant or bomb, invaded a country, never stored hate in the dark cave of their hearts like a sacred flame. I'm Bob Holman, and thank you for listening to Poetry is Bread. Subscribe to our podcast to get notifications of new episodes. Check us out at BoweryPoetry.com. The podcast is co-produced by Ram Devanini and Flavia Rocha with Retiplex. Artwork by Fabian Ceruleo. This podcast series is funded by National Endowment for the Arts and New York State Council on the Arts, the Governor of New York State, and the New York State Legislature. Thank you all. Thank you all for listening. Poetry, it goes in one ear and stays there.